the issue is and the main rub is, can you access coal in an environmentally responsible manner?
A new technology to tap into Cook Inlet coal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 30th of June. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, the ACLU sues to protect the medical privacy of a group of women in Ketchikan.
In Alaska in particular, we expect and are guaranteed by our Constitution a very robust right to privacy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Summer is here and low tides may beckon recreational shellfish harvesters. However, clams, cockles, and mussels dug from the state's beaches can contain lethal levels of paralytic shellfish poisoning toxins, PSP. Because Alaska's recreational and subsistence beaches are not tested for PSP, people should not harvest shellfish from these areas. Information at 907-269-7501 or visit www.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Anchorage officials are responding to a lawsuit filed against the city. Papers were filed yesterday by two Anchorage Police Department officers, Elvin Kennedy and Eleazar Feliciano, alleging discrimination within the police department. Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew told reporters that the APD does not tolerate racism.
When employees or citizens have complaints about the Anchorage Police Department, whether those are racial in nature or related to other performance-related issues, there are many avenues for them to go to address those complaints, and we look into them. Most, if not all, of these allegations are issues that the police department has dealt with already. We're going through the paperwork. We're comparing it to our own files and to the other investigations from the other agencies that may have looked at these complaints to see if there's a one-to-one relationship there. But I think it's fair to say that most, if not all of these, have already made it through other forums, and most, if not all of them, have already been found to be without merit.
Mew says he is not aware of any pattern of racial profiling within the department. The two officers who filed the suit worked as undercover officers. Both have 20-year histories with APD. City Attorney Dennis Wheeler says the city has 20 days to respond to the suit. He says the city has not yet been served with the complaint. Wheeler says the plaintiffs want the court to find evidence of discrimination and are seeking a financial settlement. Cook Inlet Region Incorporated has joined with a Texas-based energy company to tap into coal deposits on the west side of Cook Inlet. But there will be no mining involved due to a unique process which converts the coal to gas beneath the ground. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the project marks Ceres' venture into the energy generation business.
Ethan Schutt is Cook Inlet Region's Senior Vice President of Land and Energy. He's been heading Ceres attempts to be the first company in Alaska to use underground coal gasification technology, or UCG, to exploit huge coal deposits beneath Ceres land across Cook Inlet from Anchorage. Ceres announced last fall that it would drill 6 exploratory wells to determine if conditions were right for UCG.
We encountered, probably hundreds of coal seams in those holes, some that were, inches thick, some that were feet thick, some that were very dirty and discontinuous. And what we took samples for lab purposes was from intervals that were clean, continuous, thick, and deeply buried.
So far, the first round of resource assessment drilling has been completed, yielding data from 5 of the drill locations. Schutt says the coal samples are headed to the lab for analysis. Ceres has also formed a joint venture with Houston-based Lauris Energy to develop and market synthetic gas, which is the product produced by the UCG process. UCG has not been commercially deployed in the United States, although it is used in Australia and South Africa. The process uses air, a combustion source, and pressure to convert coal to gas. Schutt says the entire process takes place underground and likens the process to a well, not a mine.
The issue is, and the main rub is, can you access coal in an environmentally responsible manner? It is hard to ignore the coal resource in our domestic energy mix because it represents 50% of the power generation in the United States. And so our view and vision of the UCG technology is that it is the best of both worlds.
Loris Energy develops underground coal technology projects in North America as an affiliate of Ergo Exergy, a company based in Montreal.
Loris's role and expertise is that they have the license to use the proprietary Ergo technology in North America.
The new joint venture is to be called Stonehorn Ridge. CERI is aiming to start producing commercial quantities of synthetic gas by 2015 if all goes according to plan.
We do intend at some point to build new electrical generation facility that would be fed largely or exclusively by syngas. Whether we can bring that on in this 2014-2015 timeframe, I don't know. The other thing that could come on relatively quickly is the Agrium fertilizer facility at Nikiski. Can be fed with syngas. We'll be looking really hard at that and trying to arrive at a commercial deal with Agrium.
Permitting for the proposed UCG facility is in the discussion phase. State Division of Land, Mining and Water Coal Regulatory Program Manager Russell Kirkham says the exploratory drill sites are being inspected this week. Kirkham says existing regulations are concerned with the surface effects of coal mining, although the UCG process is covered under the Surface Mining and Reclamation Act. Shutt says CERI is sensitive to potential impacts of the development as it is on CERI land, and the Native Corporation plan is for a minimal footprint with minimal personnel. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
After 5 years of negligence, a Seattle-based seafood company agreed to pay a hefty fine to the EPA for violating the Clean Water Act in the Bering Sea. From member station KUCB, Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Highland Light Seafoods, a Seattle-based seafood company, has been fined $135,000 by the Environmental Protection Agency for violating the Clean Water Act in Alaska waters. An EPA inspection in 2008 revealed that the company's catcher processor, the Westward Wind, had been in violation of environmental standards for 5 years. The Westward Wind did not comply with its National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit and discarded more seafood waste than it was permitted to by law. In 2006, the Westward Wind dumped waste near the Pribilof Islands without a permit. Chris Gebhardt, a compliance officer with the EPA, says that the area is given special protections because of the island's exceptionally diverse bird population and its large marine mammal population.
We did cover almost all seafood processors under a general permit, except for in special areas. And one of these areas is the Pribilof Islands, where we created a special general permit with more reporting requirements because of the sensitivity and the ecological importance of the Pribilof Islands.
Gebhardt says the Westward Wind also violated its pollutant elimination permit when it discarded seafood waste in Nazan Bay off Atka Island. Nazan Bay is a shallow cove with little water flow, which increases the likelihood that waste could collect on the ocean floor. For almost 5 years, the Westward Wind failed to maintain accurate records that would keep track of how much waste was discarded and how large the pieces of waste were. Because vessels self-report this information, the figures they provide are vitally important to the EPA, says Gebhardt.
One fundamental requirement is that every day they go and they make sure that their grinder is working by taking a sample and making sure that the grind size is less than half of an inch, and in shore bays or nearshore areas conduct those other type of inspections like checking the seashore or the shoreline or the sea surface to make sure that there's not larger fish parts, also demonstrating that maybe your grinding system isn't working or you're bypassing fish. So they never kept logs of those monitoring activities, which we need to ensure that kind of monitoring was taking place.
Highland Light is part of the Yard'em Knot group. In 2004, Yard'em Knot was fined $11,000 by the EPA for fish waste violations at its land-based facility in Naknek. Alan Chafee, president of Yard'em Knot, did not return a request for comment. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The nation's aging icebreaker fleet is breaking down. The U.S. Coast Guard has three icebreakers, and two of them are now down for repairs. Today, the Coast Guard announced that the icebreaker Polar Sea will not be making its planned summer trip to the Arctic because of engines that are at risk of failing. Coast Guard Chief Petty Officer Dana Warr says the vessel was built in 1978 and refurbished in 2006, but its main engine is already showing significant signs of wear.
That condition could lead to a catastrophic engine failure, which obviously exposes the ship and its crew to possibility of a crankcase explosion, engine fire, shrapnel that could damage other equipment, and even injure some of the crew members.
The Polar Sea is one of two heavy Coast Guard icebreakers. The other one, the Polar Star, was already under repair and won't be ready for another 2 years. That leaves just one U.S. icebreaking vessel, the larger but less powerful cutter, the Healy, which is now plying the ice of the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas on a scientific mission. The Polar Sea was a key part of the Coast Guard's push to increase its Arctic presence due to diminishing sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. Last year, the vessel supported a number of safety drills and medical and other missions in coastal communities along the Arctic shore in an operation called Arctic Crossroads. It was supposed to do the same sort of thing this year and also conduct oil spill response drills. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state steps in to try to turn around a failing school district.
We don't blame the teachers. It's difficult for them. There's a lot of turnover in rural districts.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The ACLU says a lawsuit it filed in Ketchikan could set a new standard for medical privacy in Alaska. The group is suing the state to recover records seized from a women's health center during a criminal investigation. It says local police later revealed personal medical information. Police deny that's the case. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska says state officials took about 400 patient files while investigating a Ketchikan women's clinic. ACLU Executive Director Jeffrey Mittman says that could open intimate details of the women's lives to public scrutiny.
In Alaska in particular, we expect and are guaranteed by our Constitution a very robust right to privacy. And when government comes in and violates that right, not only by improperly seeking information it's not entitled to, but then not exercising its authority to protect that information, that's a situation that we must, as the ACLU, always seek to address.
A complaint filed in Ketchikan Superior Court says the records were seized during a January Medicaid fraud investigation into a clinic called A Woman's Place. The ACLU says information taken described gynecological services, reports of sexual abuse, and testing for sexually transmitted diseases. ACLU attorney Tom Stenson says Ketchikan's police department assisted Alaska Medicaid Fraud Control Unit staff.
They did look through the files, and we did have several complaints that women were later confronted by officers saying, "I know what illness you have." Or that members of their family were confronted.
The ACLU says in one case, an officer told a woman her mother had a sexually transmitted disease. The city contests the claims.
I remain very confident, as does the chief of police, that no Ketchikan police officer has acted improperly.
Municipal attorney Stephen Bradford says officials talked to the officers involved in the search. They were told that medical information was not to be discussed. And Bradford says the city's investigation shows it wasn't.
Each of the officers involved has assured us that they did not in any way divulge that information. And frankly, the city would take very seriously if any officer did act in that manner.
The suit seeks immediate return of the records. The ACLU's Stenson says the group also wants changes in the state's Medicaid fraud unit's evidence-gathering system.
There need to be more strict regulations from the court about how medical records are seized and handled. We want to make sure that where search warrants are approved for the unit, that they're very narrowly tailored to a specific investigation and that they're not a big fishing expedition over the course of 6 months into hundreds of medical records.
The state is not responding in detail to the suit's allegations, but law department spokesman Bill McAllister says women whose files were seized can get copies from the state through their medical providers. The suit does not include Ketchikan police. ACLU Director Mittman says that's because his group and the city are working on an out-of-court agreement. He says attempts to reach a similar agreement with the state failed. Law Department spokesman McAllister says the parties came to terms on many points, but the state felt the rest went too far. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The major candidates for U.S. Senate are about a third of the way into this year's primary election season, and the next 2 months indicate that voters will have a lot of things to consider when they go to the polls. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The race attracting the most attention so far this year is the Republican primary, with statewide newcomer Joe Miller challenging incumbent Lisa Murkowski, who's up for re-election. Miller's been campaigning on a nationally based theme that solving the country's problems will only come from a change in national leadership. He says he's getting a good response to his message, and he says people see him as part of the answer to the nation's economic problems.
People are looking for those that really come from outside of the system that are interested in the constitutional approach, which is a much more limited government approach than what we've seen over the last few decades.
Miller says Murkowski does not have the answer to national economic issues, and his answer to those issues is to restrict government, stop its growth, and, quote, get the fiscal house in order by not spending more money. Senator Murkowski was working at the Capitol and preparing for a trip to Alaska this weekend, but her re-election spokesman, Steve Wachowski, calls Miller's campaign doom and gloom that doesn't consider the work Murkowski's done. He says the senator has fought the meteoric growth of government for a long time.
She voted against Obama's stimulus package, voted against the appropriations bill. She thinks that we need to create jobs, not bigger government here in this country. But the greatest asset we have is American our freedoms, and we can pull through this. This is the land of optimism.
Congress, however, is not limited to one subject. Members also deal with local and personal issues, such as native issues, land claims, veterans issues. Wachowski says while the senator sees the economy at the heart of the campaign, she knows that being a senator goes beyond that.
She views it as her job. If people, the federal government has made promises to people because they either have served or paid into Social Security, she'll follow, make sure that the federal government follows through, you know, with its promises.
Miller sees the national economy as the overriding issue, to be dealt with even in consideration of other needs.
Anything that involves government expenditures is all going to be subject to cut. I think Alaskans and Americans as a whole are willing to do some belt tightening to get this fiscal house back in order. So, you know, I don't have a specific platform on any of those issues that you mentioned, but I will tell you that there is virtually not a program that is not going to have some fiscal limitation.
The winner of the Republican primary will face the winner of the Democratic primary in November. Scott McAdams is working for that place on the ballot. He says it's all local, and that's what he's promoting as he travels the state. McAdams says Alaska is based on energy, new oil development, gas, renewable energy, but he says it doesn't stop there.
We also continue to go out and make the case for why every one of our towns, every one of our communities matters, why it's important that our commercial fisheries are advanced at the national level, that our next senator from Alaska understands that small town fishermen are more important than corporate lobbyists. And you know, we're making progress. We're getting out talking to a lot of folks, and we're changing hearts and minds one voter at a time.
McAdams is mayor of Sitka and says it was obvious to him a month ago that he was not well recognized beyond there, But he says he is making progress, and he says he'll be prepared for whomever the Republicans choose. The party primary elections will take place August 24th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The state education department is intervening to help the poorest performing school district in the state. The Upete district serves about 450 students in the villages of Akiachuk, Tuluksak, and Akiak. It has been failing to meet the Federal Adequate Yearly Progress, or AYP, standards for 4 years. Today, the State Department of Education announced it will send retired educator Daryl Sanborn as a trustee to work with the district to improve student performance. It's the first school where the state has intervened under the AYP standard as required by the federal No Child Left Behind law. Department of Education Information Officer Eric Fry says Sanborn will work with local school district officials, teachers, and parents to help boost student performance scores.
We have targets that schools are supposed to meet each year for the percentage of students who are proficient in language arts and math. And if a district doesn't meet the targets for year after year, we ask them to create an improvement plan. It's a further step in an intervention the state's been involved in for about 5 years now. And that intervention has involved sending experienced Alaska educators and curriculum specialists and assessment specialists out to the school district to help.
The state trustee's job is to monitor the Upete School District's plan for teacher development and to help the district to meet best practices for instruction. Fry says no Upete School District personnel will lose their jobs, nor is any blame being put on teachers there.
We don't blame the teachers. It's difficult for them. There's a lot of turnover in rural districts. You know, when you're new as a teacher, you just don't know what's involved. And when people graduate with a degree and education, there's still a lot to know about being a good teacher. And so that's why we have mentors going in and helping them. And it's also the teachers aren't responsible for everything. They don't set the curriculum. They don't make sure the curriculum aligns with the standards. That's the responsibility of the district.
Fry says there is no deadline for improvement. He says the trustee will stay in place for at least 3 years until all three schools improve their reading, writing, and math scores. Tucked along the south side of South Central Foundation's complex of modern medical facilities is the traditional healing garden. Even with traffic whizzing along on nearby Tudor Road, it's a peaceful urban haven. I visited the garden as part of our series on Alaska Native education. Traditional healing clinic manager Buzz Daney showed me around.
It's very calming and you know, it's kind of nice during the summer. You'll see on some of these islands throughout the parking lot that people will be kind of just sitting on rocks and stuff. And I think that's the best waiting room in the world. You know, I think it's just amazing.
Danny points to a plant called wormwood sage. The leaves are smooth but have jagged edges, similar to a thistle.
Commonly called stinkweed, but it seems to proliferate through Alaska. Chifluk in my wife's language, and it's a very common medicine. It can be used externally and internally, and in the very least used as a tea when you have a cough, cold, maybe a flu.
Back inside the traditional healing clinic, Danny says the medicine plant garden is meant to educate about the healing properties of wild plants.
We use the garden for educational purposes. We use it to demonstrate just what an abundance of traditional medicines and plants, edible teas, that have been used since time immemorial on behalf of the Alaska Native people. There's a deep, rich knowledge about this that is just waiting to be shared.
Danny says the plants are not prescribed to patients or what he calls customer owners because of concerns over possible unknown interactions with other prescription medicine. But he says learning about the preventative nature of the plants is important.
A lot of the way that you learn about the plant, learn about how it can help you heal, is a part of the healing, that gaining that knowledge on what's going on with you as a person seeking to fix an ailment.
Danny says part of the learning process is discovering that often a weed is not just a weed.
Even dandelions, you know, have a medicinal aspect to them. And of course, the leaves can be eaten like in a salad. And, you know, when I'm on the coastal trail riding my bike, I see people collecting these so-called weeds and things, and I'm sure they have the intention of eating them.
Although there is wide concern in Native communities about the loss of traditional knowledge as culture bears pass on, Danny is optimistic that more is retained than people may realize.
I believe it's still there. The way I've been taught to understand is that even those old-growth trees and the earth remembers, and that we have our own genetic memory that plays a part to bring back that little thing, and to keep learning and learning together. I use that phrase, sharing knowledge, a lot. You know, there's something that triggers a memory. Maybe something pops up that maybe was forgotten, or maybe that it was remembered from before I was even born.
He points to solid evidence of retention and sharing of traditional knowledge in Alaska.
We have had some that have documented their work. Della Keats, the first tribal doctor to really share knowledge and what she did, and being very open and encouraging us to train the future generations so it wouldn't be lost. And she's done that quite successfully. We have Minilux Tribal Doctor School in Kotzebue, for example, and that's spreading to Barrow and some other places. So, and that includes, at least in their realm, the plant medicine.
Garden pictures, links to medicinal plant information, and more stories in our Native Education series can be found at our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Today is the final day in our year-long series on Alaska Native education. You can find archived stories from the series on our website at aprn.org. Follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
And by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.